everyone, and welcome back to the New Plaza Cinema Podcast, the podcast made by cinephiles for cinephiles. Considering how much we love famed director Billy Wilder at New Plaza Cinema, we figured now would be as good a time as any to revisit his highly regarded 1960 classic, The Apartment, with Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine at their finest, all the while exploring how it fits into the rest of Wilder's filmography in depth with prolific Emmy-nominated film historian and writer, Joseph McBride. So with all that being said, we hope you enjoy this special episode.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this edition on which we discuss Billy Wilder's masterpiece from 1960 with our very special guest, Joseph McBride, who will be joining us in just a little while. Gary Palmucci, who normally is part of these discussions, is very busy, but I know he's a huge fan of The Apartment, which was first released in the United States to cinemas on June 15th, 1960. Technically, that will be the final year of the artistically rich decade of the 1950s. This is producer-director Billy Wilder at the height of his powers. In addition to winning an Academy Award for Best Picture, The Apartment also won for Director. The original screenplay by Wilder and his brilliant co-partner, I.A.L. Diamond, the black and white art direction of Alexander Trauner, and the editing of Daniel Mandel. The film remains one of Wilder's greatest achievements and one of Hollywood's enduring masterworks. In its satirical skewering of corporate America and the 1950s rat race, seldom has a motion picture walked a fine line between hilarity and tragedy as this one, where insurance company bean counter C.C. Baxter makes his Manhattan walk-up pad available to philandering executives who promise him career advancement. From the soullessness of corporate life to the sleazy excesses of executive privilege, The Apartment still resonates with audiences today, clearly from all over the world. We'll talk more about that. But let's begin with the original theatrical trailer for the film from distributor United Artists. If Gary were here, I suspect he would agree with me that this trailer looks as though it was thrown together in about 10 minutes by the UA sales staff. It's a pity we really don't get a sense of the film's brilliance from this rather uninspired narration.
Ingredient number one, a very warm, very wonderful story about a boy, a girl, and a very special kind of problem.
Did you hear what I said, Miss Kubelik? I absolutely adore you.
But hey, it worked in 1960. People went to see it, and it became a tremendous hit. Now, in fairness to the UA sales staff, while the trailer was a little uninspired, the original poster for The Apartment, I think, is pretty good. I mean, it's not the greatest artwork, but I like the copy for the original poster. Movie-wise, there has never been anything like The Apartment. Love-wise, laugh-wise, or otherwise-wise. Clearly, the person who wrote that copy had seen the film, because it's a play on the corporate jargon that Jack Lemmon and other executives use in the insurance company offices. So that's how The Apartment was originally sold in 1960. But now it gives me great pleasure to introduce our special guest, Joseph McBride. He's a film historian and a professor in the School of Cinema at San Francisco State University. He's published 24 books, most recently the critical study, The Whole Dern Human Comedy, Life According to the Coen Brothers, which we saw a cover of. Laurie had mentioned there's an updated version of this amazing Whatever Happened to Orson Welles, A Portrait of an Independent Career, which I can't wait to see the revised version of that. The Political Truth, The Media, and the Assassination of President Kennedy, and of course, his brilliant critical study, Billy Wilder, Dancing on the Edge, from Columbia University Press. And he's also written a fantastic book on Ernst Lubitsch, How Did Lubitsch Do It? He's also written biographies of Frank Capra, Steven Spielberg, and John Ford. And if you haven't seen the Orson Welles film, The Other Side of the Wind, on Netflix, it's only available on Netflix. It's the long-in-making film that finally came out in 2018, the gadfly film critic and historian Mr. Pister, who is constantly pestering John Huston's Jake Hannaford with inane, pretentious questions. That's Joseph McBride. He's received Emmy and Writers Guild of America awards, nominations for his writing of American Film Institute Life Achievement Award tributes to Fred Astaire, Lillian Gish, John Huston. And if that isn't enough, he's also done audio commentaries for 8 Billy Wilder films, most recently the Kino Lorber releases of The Apartment and Some Like It Hot. Needless to say, Joseph McBride, we are honored to have you with us today at New Plaza Cinema.
Great to be here, Max. Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be with everybody from all around the world. That's fantastic, the range of our reach here.
Well, before we get to The Apartment, a little backgrounder in your interest in Billy Wilder. Presumably you met him on several occasions. Could you give us some idea of how your interest in Wilder started?
Yeah, this is a picture of me behind us, of me talking with him in 1995. I gave him the Career Achievement Award from the LA Film Critics Association. I was aware of him. Actually, the first film I saw twice in a theater was Wilder's 1957 film, The Spirit of St. Louis, a very anomalous film that he did about Charles Lindbergh with Jimmy Stewart. And I was so impressed, I went back to see it. But Some Like It Hot was a big event for me as a kid. I was a very repressed Catholic kid. And could you imagine going to see Some Like It Hot in 1959 when I was 11, I guess, and seeing cross-dressing and Marilyn Monroe, who I had a big crush on, as everybody did. And she was very sexy, but very vulnerable, very three-dimensional, very, very great film. Had a huge impact on me. I missed The Apartment when it came out for some reason, but a film that had a big influence on me was Irma LaDuce, which Wilder made in 1963. That was his most popular film. And it also stars Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine. It's about prostitution, as is The Apartment in its way. But Irma LaDuce is kind of a lighthearted romp in Paris, very beautiful pastel colors. That was Wilder's most popular film. And I was a student in a Catholic high school in Milwaukee, and I went to see it, and I was so scandalized that I left in the middle. I thought, this is, you know, I was fascinated, but scandalized. And then I went back to see it again, and I made it almost to the end, but when she has the baby in the church at the end, I walked out again. I just thought I shouldn't be there. And I went back a third time, and I finally made it all the way through, which I thought was a landmark in my sex education. So Billy Wilder was my sex education teacher. And I think he helped raise the sophistication level of the whole American audience, which was struggling to get out of our puritanical heritage. It kind of helped free me, and the Legion of Decency condemned some of his films. And when I was still a Catholic kid, every year we had to stand up in church and pledge we wouldn't see any condemned films. And in 1965, I came back from college at the University of Wisconsin and refused to stand for the pledge. And my father was very angry at me. And that was my first overt break with the church. And I think a lot of that was inspired by Irma LaDuce and Some Like It Hot. So thank you, Mr. Wilder. And then I began writing about him 52 years ago. Michael Wilmington, who died recently, and I were writing partners, and we wrote a piece for Film Quarterly called The Private Life of Billy Wilder, which was a career overview. This is 52 years ago, and, you know, I've evolved in my thinking about him somewhat, but it still holds up pretty well. And then we reviewed Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, which was slighted by the American audience and reviewers because Wilder, in response to the freeing of the American screen with sex and language and violence, he became more romantic. I think he was always a kind of a closeted romantic, a secret romantic. I.L. Diamond, his writing partner, called him a disappointed romantic. But he was, I call Wilder the bull in the china shop of American Puritanism in the 50s. He was breaking all the crockery, but by the 60s, all the crockery was broken. So what was he going to do? He turned more romantic. He made Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, which is a beautiful film, and we gave it a good review. And I reviewed Avanti in 1972, which is, I think, my favorite Wilder film, very romantic film. He tried to do Lubitsch types of films throughout his career and never quite succeeded until Avanti. And I wrote a review called The Importance of Being Ernst for Film Heritage, I guess it was. And then in 1974, I moved to California in 73, and I went on the set of The Front Page, his newspaper film based on the Ben Heck, Charles MacArthur play. And I interviewed Wilder, and I spent a day watching him shoot, which was invaluable. And he was very approachable, and old newspaper guys like me and Wilder, I mean, I started in 1960 and he started in 1924 as a newspaper guy before he became a filmmaker. We kind of recognized each other, and he was very quotable, very brilliant guy to talk to. And I interviewed Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau and other people involved in the film. And so over the years, I interviewed Wilder a number of times and did a long interview with him in 1978 with Todd McCarthy for Film Comment. And I had it in the back of my mind to write a book about him for many years, and I finally got around to it. And I was going to write a book on Wilder and Lubitsch together. I thought that was a clever idea. And I spent about a year doing that around 2010. And then I realized they're as different as they are similar. You know, Lubitsch was Wilder's mentor. But I was teaching a course on them at San Francisco State, and I realized how different they are in substantial ways. So I broke off the Wilder part, and I thought, well, I'll write a whole book on him. And I got back to it after the Lubitsch book. And also, his career was huge. I mean, I write about his journalism, then I write about his German filmmaking, which most people don't know much about, and his early Hollywood screenplays, which are pretty well ignored. And I wrote about those, and then all the films he directed in America. So it's a long, complex book. But, you know, at this point in my career, I pick books that are fun to do. And what could be more fun than studying Ernst Lubitsch and Billy Wilder?
Absolutely. And the book, you pointed this out yourself, it's not a biography. It is a critical study. You're examining his life and his films, but it's not a then he did this and then he did that type of thing. And it is fascinating that you were able to, I believe you actually had to go to Germany just to see some of the early films he wrote as a screenwriter before fleeing in 1933, because they're not available.
Yeah, I went to Germany twice to see Lubitsch films because they were hard to see in America. More and more of them are filtering in, but still some of them have never been released in America. So I went there and I went to Switzerland. In that research, I also studied Wilder because he spent several years in Berlin. And for example, to see his first film credit, Der Teufel's Reporter, which was The Devil's Reporter, I had to see that at the National Archive in Berlin. And also I watched Fanfares of Love, which is a 1953 film that was what Some Like It Hot was a remake of that film. And you really can't see that except going to Berlin. So, it's very important. Goethe, the German poet, said, to understand a poet, you must go unto the poet's land. So I did that with Lubitsch and Wilder, and I do that with other Spielberg. He lived in five cities growing up, so I did it five times over. Wilder was in exile several times over. He was born in what is now Poland, and he and his family moved to Krakow first, and his parents had a hotel, and then they moved to Vienna, and he spent his formative years, I guess you would call them his adolescent years, Vienna. He became a journalist there. And then he moved to Berlin in 1926, and then he had to leave because of Hitler. He went to Paris for a year. He co-directed a film there called Mauvaise Grande. And then he came to America. And then I think in the last 21 years of his life, I say he was in internal exile in the United States. He wasn't allowed to make a film in Hollywood after 1981. And when I gave my speech about him in 1995, I was really vehement about how Hollywood had turned its back on this great filmmaker. I remember one time I was in the Universal Commissary talking to a producer who was interested in my work, and she said, I can't get anybody to direct a romantic comedy today. Nobody knows how to direct a romantic comedy. I said, well, what about Billy Wilder? You know, and she looked at me, Billy Wilder? She said, he's not bankable. And that kind of shows you the stupid attitude people had toward him. And what a shame, you know, neglecting this great filmmaker. And part of what drives me to write a book is feeling that some subject or person has been neglected or done an injustice to. And Wilder has had many great honors. He won 3 Oscars for The Apartment. He was the first person who got Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Screenwriter with I.L. Diamond all at once. 7 other people have done it since, but he was at the pinnacle in terms of his prestige in 1960. And then gradually he began losing his audience, but made some of his best films. And I felt his later films have been unfairly slighted and neglected, and a lot of people haven't even seen some of them. And then his earlier films were misunderstood to some extent. And I try to question and criticize the simplistic attitude that he was simply a cynic. I don't think he was. I call him a disappointed romantic, as Diamond put it. And then also the idea that he was a misogynist, I think, doesn't hold water. There are many good women in his films, people who we really admire, such as Shirley MacLaine, even though she's a flawed human being. And Molly Haskell, who's written some great work on women in the cinema, thinks that one reason Wilder's work holds up so well today is he's unsentimental, unlike a lot of classic Hollywood films. And he's unsentimental about women as well as men. And people sometimes mistake that for being misogynistic, but there are about three or four women in his films who are really rotten. People like Barbara Stanwyck and Dublin Town that he's a psychopath, but there are a lot of women who you really admire in his films, strong women, but they're very complex, just like the men in his films. And then I'd like to trace how somebody becomes who they are. And Wilder had this long apprenticeship as a journalist and screenwriter. And I was just interested too in seeing these films. It's a selfish motive I have when I write a book, is I want to see the early work and see how he developed. And I found some films in Germany and even in Hollywood in the earlier period that were, mixed bags, but they had some wonderful things in them. But they taught me a lot about Wilder. I mean, just for the fact that he made a lot of musicals in his career. Who thinks of him as a director of musicals? But we could go into that. At Germany, they had a lot of music and films. They put it in to entertain the masses, and he was kind of stuck with musical interludes and comedies. But some of the songs are good and some are not so good. And then in Hollywood, he was kind of typecast with the same kind of films until he did Ninotchka for Ernst Lubitsch. And that was his real big breakthrough.
But it's interesting because the 1940s really was a very dramatic year for Billy Wilder. A very dramatic decade. It's not a decade filled with comedies. You know, you do have The Major and The Minor. You do have A Foreign Affair, and I know The Emperor Waltz, which is not the favorite among a lot of Wilder followers, but there's some serious, serious dramas there. And then as the late 50s and the 60s arrive, comedy plays a very, very major part. And the Apartment is kind of in the middle because it walks this amazing line between drama and comedy. I can't think of many films that have done it as successfully.
Yeah, when I was giving Wilder that award, I had lunch with him and Jack Lemmon, and I said to Wilder, what do you think is your best film? And he said, The Apartment. And I said, why? And he said, because it's my best mixture of comedy and drama. And he said, that was the mixture I was trying to achieve my whole life. And it's a seamless mixture. It's beautifully integrated. The screenplay by him and Diamond is a classic. You can read it. It's available in print. But it's very daring because it pirouettes from farce to tragedy or near tragedy. For example, a key scene, Diamond mentioned this in an interview, when Jack Lemmon finds out that Shirley MacLaine has been having trysts with his boss in his apartment, he's devastated. He goes to a bar and gets drunk, and we saw the shot of Hope Holiday.
"'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring. Nothing. No action. Dullsville. You married?
Nope.
Family?
Nope.
Night like this, it sort of spooks you to walk into an empty apartment."
Who's wonderful in the film. It's very funny. You know, they both get sloshed and he takes her back to his apartment and it's sort of farcical. And then he finds out that Shirley MacLaine is in his bed and she's overdosed. But Hope Holiday's character doesn't understand what's going on. And so there's this kind of, on one side of the screen is this farcical thing. Jack Lemmon is getting frantic and she doesn't know why. And, you know, he's running next door to get help and she thinks he's going for ice cubes. Diamond said that the line was very thin between tragedy and comedy. He said if there was a laugh in the wrong place, it might have really hurt the film. And so they were holding their breath at the preview, and it worked. The audience got the point. You know, they didn't laugh at the serious parts. They laughed at the funny parts. But Hope Holiday is being dragged out of the apartment by Jack Lemmon, and poor woman doesn't know what's going on. And she told me she lost one of her shoes and she was being dragged across the linoleum floor, and then she's trying to hold on to her shoes and she's being shoved out the door and he's frantically trying to rescue Shirley MacLaine. So that's a great example, but it's very daring because most screenwriters would have been content just to show her overdosing and make it a straight drama. But Wilder gave an interview. Some critics at the time didn't understand this picture because he was always breaking ground. American audiences back then were not very used to shifting tones like that. And I found a review by Bosley Crowther in the New York Times who was very clueless.
Unusual.
Notoriously clueless critic. he reviewed Truffaut's Shoot the Piano Player in 1962, and he couldn't understand the shifts of tones. You know, he said, sometimes it's funny, sometimes it's, you know, somebody gets shot, and what's going on? Truffaut's gone haywire in this film. And Hollis Alpert on Saturday Review wrote the most clueless review of The Apartment. He didn't like the shifts of tones. He called the film a dirty fairy tale with a schnook hero and a sad little elevator operator as a princess. And Wilder was offended at first, but then he thought, oh, dirty fairy tale. Yeah, it is kind of a dirty fairy tale. He began to think that was good. But Alpert was so confused that he actually thought the film was endorsing Jack Lemmon lending out his apartment to his superiors for sex so he could get promoted. I mean, he totally misunderstood this film. And so some of the audience just didn't get it, but the film became a big hit, and to the credit of the American audience, they really appreciated it and they understood it. It helped advance our sophistication, and Wilder deserves a lot of credit for that, just as Lubitsch did earlier. That whole wave of European Jewish filmmakers who emigrated had a huge impact on American cinema, because we were very Victorian still when Lubitsch came over. And Wilder, with his dark sense of humor, said Lubitsch was one of the talented ones who was called to Hollywood. He didn't have to flee like I did. And he made American cinema very sophisticated with his romantic comedies and musicals. And then Wilder comes along and breaking a lot of taboos and navigating the system very cleverly, both of them, getting around censorship and pushing the envelope of it. But anyway, some critic at the time of The Apartment said to Wilder, the film was too sentimental. I guess he means it has a kind of a qualified happy ending. It's very realistic. But Wilder said, I made the film so as not to be sentimental. And then he made an extraordinary comment. He said, I don't consider The Apartment a comedy. I think it's a drama. And he said, I portray Americans as beasts. I mean, what a strong comment. When he lets his hair down, it's a very scathing indictment of sexual hypocrisy and the corporate mindset. And it's about two very regular people. We can all relate to these two working class people who are stuck in this corporate trap and corruption, and they manage to get out of it through their basic decency. And that's kind of what the film is about.
Now, prior to The Apartment, a lot of Wilder's films, at least through the 50s after Ace in the Hole, were adaptations of some kind of a play, or there was some other source that inspired them, whereas The Apartment was an original script, was it not?
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, after he did Sunset Boulevard, which is one of his really great films, a great film about Hollywood, he broke with Charles Brackett, his first major writing partner in America. They were having some ideological and other problems. From the very beginning, as Brackett's diaries revealed, there was friction between them. They're very different. Wilder was Eastern European Jewish, wisecracking former reporter, and Brackett was a blue-blood WASP from Eastern United States, wealthy background. And he was anti-Semitic too, and the diaries sadly have numerous instances of this. And he didn't like Wilder's calling women on the phone at the office and some of his harsh arguments they had. And he carried a riding crop or a cane as he walked up and down as they worked in this irritated Brackett. And finally, they broke up. But it reveals that they broke up over the House Committee on Un-American Activities hearings in 1947. That Brackett actually supported the hearings. And he said Dalton Trumbull should have been, you know, compelled to testify. And Wilder, as an immigrant, really valued the freedoms of America, especially the First Amendment. And he said at one point in his life, he thought the Supreme Court was the most important thing about America. And now I wonder what he would think today. But he was against the blacklist. He took a strong stand against it. They had very angry arguments. And Wilder said, I don't want to work with you anymore. They still did Sunset Boulevard, I guess, because of inertia. They wanted to finish it. But Wilder said, I want to have more freedom. So then he goes without Brackett and he makes Ace in the Hole, which is his darkest film. It's a very scathing,
brilliant, yeah,
great film about American journalism. This unscrupulous reporter played by Kirk Douglas who keeps a man trapped in a cave to build up a story, and the man dies. And it's very corrosive. And of course, the audience in America recognized that he was attacking them for being gullible and buying all these sensational stories. It did better in Europe, naturally. But he was kind of running for cover for a while, as you were implying. He was adapting plays, Stalag 17, Seven-Year Itch, etc., Sabrina. You know, interesting period, but not as good as the later period. But when he gets together with Diamond, it was a big shift for him because he and Diamond were very simpatico. Diamond was Eastern European immigrant as well. He came from Romania. He came as a child, unlike Wilder, so Diamond didn't have an accent. I interviewed his son, Paul, who's a screenwriter, very helpful to me. And he said his dad, who I interviewed too on the set of The Front Page, you know, he was more fluent in English than Wilder, although, as Paul said, nobody was wittier in English than Billy Wilder. But he always felt he needed a collaborator who could help him with his insecurities about the second language. And he also is so social. He didn't want to work in an office by himself. He liked talking it out and hashing it out. They'd spend weeks or months talking about the story before they would write a script. And Diamond would do the typing, but it was all really close collaboration, and Diamond was involved in every step of the production. But what they did was, Wilder had an idea for a film in the late 40s. He had seen, this is so typical of him, he saw Brief Encounter, the romantic film that David Lean directed from a Noel Coward play called Still Life. It came out in 1945. It's about a suburban married woman, Celia Johnson, who has an affair with a doctor played by Trevor Howard. It's a beautiful film, but rather solemn, and Wilder kind of kids it in a couple of his films, and it's very romantic, and they play Rachmaninoff music on the soundtrack, and he makes fun of that in 7 Year Itch when they have the fantasy scenes where Tom Yule imagines he's seducing Marilyn Monroe.
It makes it feel goose pimply all over. I don't know where I am, or who I am, or what I'm doing. Don't stop. Don't stop. Don't ever stop. Stop.
The same music is playing. But anyway, in that movie, there's, Wilder said, I became interested in this one character who's Trevor Howard's friend, who has an apartment that the adulterous couple is going to use for their sexual tryst. And he began thinking about this guy climbing into the bed that was all disheveled and still warm from the lover's bodies, emptying the ashtrays. Those scenes actually don't happen in Brief Encounter. He was rewriting it in his mind, because in the movie, they never make it into the bed because the guy comes home unexpectedly and they take off. But it planted an idea in his mind, and it's so typical of him to think of this peripheral character who's kind of like the prototype for Bud Baxter, the schnook who has to clean up the messes and everything. But he didn't really have a plot, and also it wouldn't have been possible to do that film under censorship in the late 40s, but in 1951, there was an incident that when Wilder directed Lemon in Some Like It Hot, he loved him so much, he thought, I want to do another film with this guy. He's a genius. And he was sort of his everyman character. So he thought of this Brief Encounter nugget. And then they thought of what happened to Jennings Lang. Jennings Lang was with MCA, talent agency in Hollywood, and he was having an affair with his client, Joan Bennett, the actress. And her husband was Walter Wanger, a distinguished producer. And Wanger shot Jennings Lang in the parking lot of MCA. And the story that you always heard was that Jennings Lang was shot in the testicles and lost one of his testicles. And people made a lot of sick jokes about it. But I know his son, Rocky Lang, who's the writer-director, and he wrote a memoir. And he said he heard from the kids at school his dad was shot in the balls. And he came home and asked his mother, was my dad shot in the balls? And she said, well, I'll talk to your father. And that night, his father came home and called his son up into his study and dropped his pants and pointed to a scar on his upper thigh and said, here's where I was hit. The guy was a poor shot, fortunately. But it makes a better story to say I was shot in the balls. It's just not true. And but that gave them the hook, because Jennings Lang was using the apartment of Jay Cantor, who was a minor agent at MCA, was loaning out his apartment to him for the tryst. Cantor later became a well-known producer and studio executive. So he puts two ideas together and they come up with the apartment, and then they set it in modern New York, and they made the characters very ordinary people. But, you know, that suggests a certain connection between the apartment and the pervasive corruption of Hollywood, which I think is a criminal enterprise from top to bottom. When I came to Hollywood, I was in Wisconsin. I loved Sunset Boulevard, but I thought it was maybe too dark a portrait of Hollywood, and I thought writers in Hollywood were complaining too much. And then I got to Hollywood and I realized it was like a documentary. And I said that to Wilder, and he said, it's a Valentine. I love that. It's like, it could have been much worse the way he portrayed it. But when I moved there, I took an apartment very quickly because I was in a rush, and I found out I was about three blocks from the dump where Joe Gillis has his apartment in Sunset Boulevard, the hack screenwriter who's the patron saint of all screenwriters. And I was right up the road from the seedy hotel where Nathaniel West set a lot of Day of the Locust, the best Hollywood novel. But in Wilder's main metaphor for corruption in American capitalism is the insurance company gambling on people's life and death. And in Double Indemnity, Fred McMurray is a corrupt insurance company agent who's trying to scam the company. And he has an insurance company guy, an ace in the hole. And then Jack Lemmon works for a big insurance company, Consolidated Life. So it's kind of like that's another connection between that corporate culture and the soulless culture of Hollywood.
Without a doubt. And the Alexander Trauner settings with the endless row of desks and the fluorescent lights. And I think there was some forced perspective to the set, but that's so powerfully done to really set the setting for us about the corporate ethics and the corporate atmosphere at the time.
Yeah, you know, there's a big influence from King Vidor's 1928 film, The Crowd, which is really a great film. When Jim Aubrey was gutting MGM in the 70s, ruining the studio, selling all their props and stuff, he threw out a lot of their old screenplays. And this producer friend of mine found a dumpster on the lot filled with silent film screenplays. And he took about 10 of them home, including The Crowd, which is the best film MGM ever made. You know, I mean, that shows you how little they valued their past. But anyway, The Crowd is a great film about an ordinary couple in New York in mid-1928. It's famous for shots of this vast office with all these desks. And Orson Welles also imitated that in The Trial.
I was just going to say.
Yeah, 1962. It is Kafka-esque. Welles, on the last night of his life, being interviewed by Merv Griffin, referred to wonderful Billy Wilder, he said. So there's a connection among all those artists. So they created this archetypal image of this vast office, and fluorescent lights are really are hell on your eyes too. I used to work in offices, and you're right, they had forced perspective in the background, and they had little people sitting at desks, and then they even had some cutouts moving around. Trauner was widely considered the greatest of all art directors. He worked with Welles and other people in Wilder numerous times, Kiss Me Stupid, Emerald La Douce. And Edward Boyle worked on it too, who was Hitchcock's art director. He worked on The Apartment. So it's a magnificent film. They shot most of it in Hollywood. They shot some New York scenes. It was so cold that they came back because it was so difficult to film. Like Jack Lemmon, there's a scene that's unforgettable where he's locked out of his apartment one night because some guy's carrying on with a woman. And Lemmon is sitting on this long, long bench and he's freezing. And he's trying to sleep. It's really sad. And it was so cold, they had to spray him with antifreeze when they were shooting the scene. And they finally said, let's go back to Hollywood. And Trauner built the exterior of Lemmon's apartment on the Goldwyn lot. But they had a few establishing shots of the restaurant and things in the office building in New York, et cetera.
I love black and white cinematography, but it never looks more depressing than in a Billy Wilder film of this era. Only these are expensive Hollywood productions, but there's a bleakness to the black and white. And it's a theme that continues. I mean, I think of 1, 2, 3, Kiss Me Stupid, The Fortune Cookie. I'm fairly certain he would have continued working in black and white had the industry allowed directors to do that regularly. Any thoughts on the black and white nature of The Apartment, the look of the film?
Yeah, a really great cinematographer shot the film, Joseph Lachelle, who isn't talked about very much, but he was one of the masters. He did Laura. He got an Academy Award for that, a great film noir. He did Lubitsch's last completed film, Clooney Brown. Mm-hmm. He did Emma La Douce. He did Kiss Me Stupid, which is a really bleak look at small-town American life, but it's very elegantly shot. Wilder used the word elegant a lot when I talked to him about his style. He liked a rather unobtrusive style, but it's very beautifully choreographed, and the harmonious compositions and camera movements are all very expert. And he used the widescreen really well, but he preferred black and white, as did a lot of important directors. It stylized the films and took away some of the gaudy colors. When you have color, it's hard to control the color because your eye kind of goes in different directions. And one way to control it is to take color out of the scenes, as some directors do, and make it less bright. But it suits the sort of pastel gaudiness of Emerald La Douce. And in the later Wilder films, Sherlock Holmes and Avanti are very beautiful color films. And his style got more and more liberated as time went on, and he went outdoors more. He became more into nature, romantic nature photography, and Sherlock Holmes in a Body uses the foreign settings very beautifully. He became kind of a European filmmaker again after Hollywood kind of lost interest in him. But Kiss Me Stupid is a great film. And I really advocate a lot for his post-apartment films. Kiss Me Stupid was so corrosive in its attack on American small-town sexual hypocrisy that he and Diamond were virtually run out of town. The press outcried against it. And Diamond said he and Wilder just stared at each other for 6 months after that. They couldn't write. They said we were like a couple that just had a two-headed child and were afraid to have sexual intercourse. And then they did Fortune Cookie, which is not one of their better films. It's kind of watered down, trying to be nice to some extent, but still very bleak. Another film about an insurance scam. But then he really picked up his energies in the 70s and made some terrific films. So some of them, I mean, Front Page is a very dark, very funny play by Hecton MacArthur about journalism, which is a very harsh portrayal of journalism. But Wilder made it less funny because he made the reporters seem quite heinous in the film. And he had a lot of experience. He understood the crassness of the newspaper business. So it's kind of a cousin to Ace in the Hole, but it's done in color and it has humor. But people said, well, it's not as funny as it could have been. Well, he didn't intend it to be that funny. You know, he was getting darker and darker as time went on. Fedora is a fascinating film. It has a serious casting problem. Mark Keller is just disastrously bad in the main role. But in a way, it fits because she's playing somebody who's forced into being a double for her mother, who's a famous actress, and this poor young woman doesn't know how to act, and so Mark Keller is flailing around it. But it's kind of a re-look at Sunset Boulevard from a more jaundiced perspective, because Wilder and Diamond felt that they were kind of lost in the new Hollywood. It's, you know, they didn't understand. Wilder said, I go to see some of these movies like The Gauntlet, which is just cars crashing. And you can imagine what he would say about Michael Bay films, you know. He said, I like certain films like American Graffiti, I like it, but he said, if I were to try to do a film like that, it would be phony because it's just not my thing. And he told me on the set of The Front Page, he said, it's like if you're a great composer of polkas, but nobody's dancing the polka anymore, what do, you know? So he was a man kind of without a country in his later years.
And you do write some very compelling chapters on those later films. Your chapter on Fedora is very compelling. And of course, on Avanti, which I agree with you, is very, very underrated. And probably, I think, the last truly successful creation of a film that he did. I mean, I think an outstanding film. So The Apartment, would you agree that after The Apartment, the critical establishment, even though, as you indicated, they were not all that on board with the film, they sort of turned away or almost turned against Wilder in larger numbers after The Apartment?
Yeah, 1, 2, 3 came after that. And I know that that film has a lot of fans, but I think it's overly broad. I mean, there's some very funny things in it. It's a very broad political satire. But it's about the divided Berlin, which is not a particularly funny subject. But he liked to make humor out of dark subjects. But one thing happened when the wall went up and while they were making the film, and he had to rewrite the script to account for that. And so it seems a little anachronistic already by the time it came out. President Kennedy called Wilder to Peter Lawford's beach house while he was preparing 1, 2, 3, and he wanted to see the script of 1, 2, 3. He was worried about would it affect perception of the Berlin crisis. And Wilder, to his credit, refused to show the president the script, even though he was a liberal Democrat and admired Kennedy. That took a lot of guts for an immigrant filmmaker, but he didn't want any control over his film. And one of the German reviewers said, Billy Wilder laughs at what breaks our hearts, you know. But then the film finally, back in the 80s, 90s, has been embraced by European filmmakers and audiences. They now can see the humor with distance. You know, they said comedy is tragedy plus time, you know, but I think it's overly broad, but that's just my perspective. And Irma LaDuce, and not one of his better films, but I think the audience was moving on. The sexual revolution was coming and all kinds of turmoil in our society. But the turning point was Kiss Me Stupid. Wilder and Diamond were shocked by the reception. They thought they were making a restoration comedy. And the play by Anna Bonacci is a terrific play. It's a feminist play, actually. It does very well in Europe whenever it's performed. It's a classic. They did a stage production with Jeanne Moreau playing both roles. It was one of her first triumphs. And there's a film version with Gina Lollobrigida that's pretty good, but not as good as the Wilder film. But he said it in the contemporary world, whereas the play was set in the 1800s. If it had been more stylized, the audience probably would have accepted it. And he also had Peter Sellers playing the man who's pathologically jealous. He's kind of like an Othello who is his own Iago. He's sort of insane. And Sellers had 8 heart attacks in 1 week when they were shooting the film and had to bow out. And I interviewed Fernando Treba, who's a Spanish director who became a good friend of Wilder. And people will remember him at the Academy Awards. He got the Oscar for Bella Polk. And he said, "I would like to thank God, but I don't believe in God. I just believe in Billy Wilder." And I love that. And Wilder was mixing a martini when he heard that on TV, and he dropped the martini glass and the bottle, and his wife screamed. And the next day he called Treba. He said, "Fernando, it's God." And they were good friends already, I found out, but I thought I better interview this guy. And he told me, Wilder made some surprising comments. Treba said, "Are there some films you wish you had made?" He said, "Well, I'd rather tell you about 6 films I wish I hadn't made." And he listed 6 films that he didn't think succeeded. But he said, "The best work I ever did was the 6 weeks that I shot with Peter Sellers on Kiss Me Stupid." That was really counterintuitive, because all the other reports are that they didn't get along, and Sellers, who loved to improvise, clashed with Wilder because Wilder and Diamond were very strict about not letting actors improvise. And I saw on the set of the front page, Diamond would sit on a little stool right off camera, and he had the right to interrupt the shooting and correct the actors if they changed a line or whatever, or that he would rewrite a line on the spot if they thought it was a little better. But according to Treba, Wilder really got along with Sellers, and Sellers, with his charm, he would have stylized the film more and made it more palatable to the audience. But I like Ray Walston because he's the real thing. He looks like a small town guy, unglamorous, venal, and he's such a nasty little fellow, you know. I mean, that's why I like that film. It's corrosive. The only reviewer in America who liked that film at the time was Joan Didion, who reviewed it for Vogue magazine. And she said it shows an America we don't want to see, the true country of despair, a place where dawn breaks and it's very depressing and all the ice is melted and all the drinks and, you know, it's shabby sexuality, etc. And Americans just didn't want to see themselves reflected in the screen. It's just like what happened with Ace in the Hole. And then after that, he kind of lost his audience and he was free to be himself in a strange way.
Well, Joe, we could just go on and on. This has been a magical experience having you with us. I can only close by quoting C.C. Baxter, "Your tops, decency-wise and otherwise-wise."
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
This discussion was facilitated by resident film historian Max Alvarez. Also, a special thanks to Norma Levy, Marianne Tesler, Sean Moore, and Polly Rittenberg for making the production of this podcast possible. This podcast was produced, edited, and narrated by Hannah Kavanaugh. Yours truly. Thank you so much for tuning in, everyone, and be sure to check out the next New Plaza Cinema Talkback live on March 26th at 4 p.m., where we'll be discussing the 1940 hidden gem, Dance Girl Dance. So keep your eyes peeled for the RSVP link in the episode description. Take care, everyone.